Good evening, everyone. Welcome to New Life IVF's webinar, Getting to the Heart of Fertility. Tonight I'm joined by Dr. Hugo Fernandez, one of our great fertility specialists, and I'm Chris Russell, and together we'll be taking you through the top 10 tips we could give you to get pregnant, us as fertility specialists, rather than Dr. Google. Not that there's anything wrong with Dr. Google, but it's good to get your information from a reliable source. Tonight we're live on Vimeo, but we'll be recording this webinar and it will be up on our YouTube channel in the coming days, and it will also be released as a podcast so that you can listen to it all over again, should you choose, in the privacy of your car or wherever you like to listen. So thank you for joining us. We're about to get started. And so without any more jabbering on by me, let's get into the tips. So the first thing we talk about when thinking about getting pregnant is to make sure you ovulate. So to get pregnant, the requirements are reasonably straightforward, although at the same time incredibly complicated. But the main requirements are to have eggs, to have sperm, to have uterus, and have good fallopian tubes. So our first tip is to make sure that you ovulate. And I guess the question you might then ask is, how do you know if you ovulate? One way is to look at your cycle length. And generally, women who have a cycle length between 25 and 35 days are generally ovulating. So you can be quite confident of that. The other way to look at it is to see if your cycle is regular. Does it pretty much come at the same time each month? If it does, that supports the fact that you're ovulating as well. You can also look for physical signs. And by that, I mean you might get signs of ovulation. You might get some pain in your pelvis at the same time each month, usually about 2 weeks before your period comes, and that might indicate you're ovulating. You also might notice that there's changes to your cervical mucus. So you might notice that your mucus becomes a little bit clearer, a little bit stringier, and that indicates that ovulation is about to occur in the coming days. So there are physical signs. You can also use tracking apps, which they're a dime a dozen these days, and you can get them on your phone, and you can plug in the time of your period, and it will predict, based on what it's seen from your cycle over the previous months, it'll predict on the day on your cycle in which you're ovulating. The way that it does that is fairly straightforward. It sort of averages your usual cycle, figures out what the cycle length usually is, and subtracts 14 days. So generally you ovulate about 14 days before your period comes. So that's how the cycle tracking app works. There's also temperature charting, so you can take your temperature at the same time each day, and what you might notice is that before you ovulate, the temperature levels you get are fairly even, and then at the time of ovulation they just jump up by a fraction of a degree. And if you've got a really accurate thermometer, that can detect that as well. The other way, if there's uncertainty based on all these things, you can always have tests. And if you see doctors who do assessments of whether you ovulate, what they will do is either do a blood test, usually halfway between the time that you ovulate and when your period is due, so about a week after ovulation or a week before your period, sometimes called the day 21 test, although it's not done on day 21 for everyone. But that's a good time to do a blood test, and will show whether your progesterone hormone has risen to an adequate level, and if it has, that confirms ovulation. Ultrasounds can sometimes be helpful too, because when you have an ultrasound in a good ultrasound clinic, they'll take a good look at your ovaries and they can see some signs that either ovulation is about to happen or that ovulation has already taken place. So the ultrasound can be useful as well. The other crucial element in thinking about ovulation is thinking about your egg numbers. And I'm sure everyone's aware that with age, our egg numbers do reduce. So it becomes incredibly important that not only do you ovulate, but that you've got a good supply of eggs, because we don't want you to have just one chance of getting pregnant this month. We want you to have next month and the month after that and the month after that. And that's possible if you've got good ovarian reserve. It becomes a little bit risky if you've got low ovarian reserve to continue trying for natural pregnancies if the egg numbers are low, because you want to use your best months to get pregnant with the most efficient way of getting pregnant. So it really is important to get your egg numbers checked. And unfortunately, there's no way really that we can assess your egg numbers or give you tips on how to do that. One way is to use your age, But, you know, there's a lot of variability in egg numbers based on a woman's age. There are some women who have really good egg numbers. There are some women who are the exact same age and have very poor egg numbers. So there is a lot of variability. So we do recommend that if you have been trying to get pregnant for a little while, and generally if you're watching a webinar like this or listening to a podcast like this, that tends to mean that you've been trying to get pregnant, then it might be worth having your ovarian reserve assessed by doing an AMH test, which some of you might have heard of, or by doing a pelvic ultrasound scan that actually takes a look at your ovaries and is able to assess the number of eggs that are available within it. The next thing to think about if you're comfortable that you're ovulating is to get your timing right. And what we're talking about there is making sure that you're having sex at the right time in your cycle. And the first question, I guess, in timing goes back to what I was talking about, ovarian reserve, and thinking about what month is your most fertile. And for most women, unless you're less than 30, and certainly if you're over 30, unless you're less than 30, and certainly if you're over 35, the most fertile month from a fertility point of view is this month. And then gradually, unfortunately, every month after that, you're getting just a tiny little bit less fertile. So this month is your most fertile. Your next month is the second most fertile. The month after that is the third most fertile. So what I'm getting at here is that the first thing with your timing, as well as knowing the time in your month when you're fertile, the timing is right. You've got to get the timing right from an age point of view. And this little graph that's up on the screen now shows your chance of getting pregnant on a day of your cycle. But I just want to draw your attention firstly to the differences between the two lines on the graph. The top line, which goes up much higher, and by higher meaning a higher chance of getting pregnant, that's in a woman who is younger. And the bottom line, which is a little bit lower, is in women who are over 35. So as you can see, compared to your early 20s, if you compare your early 20s to your late 30s, you're about half as likely to get pregnant. Moving on to the timing in your cycle, what this graph also shows is your probability of getting pregnant if you have sex on a particular day in your cycle relative to ovulation. So I'll come back to what that means in a minute. But everyone just assumes that they're most fertile on the day that the egg is released, on the day of ovulation. But if you look at this graph, you'll actually see that's not the case. The peak fertility, your highest chance of having a baby, is if you have sex 2 days before. And in fact, this surprises a lot of people. You're actually more fertile if you have sex 4 days before ovulation rather than the actual day of ovulation. So what we therefore have to think, if you know when you are ovulating, then the best chance is 2 days before that, or 4 days before that is the second best day, followed as a sort of bit of a distant last by the day of ovulation. If you have to therefore calculate what day of your cycle it is, ovulation usually occurs 14 days before your period. So therefore your most fertile day is therefore 16 days before your period, the second most fertile day is 18 days before your period, and the third most fertile time is 14 days before your period. So on the basis of this, we normally recommend that your best chance of getting pregnant naturally is to have sex 4 days before your before ovulation, 2 days before ovulation, and the day of ovulation, so every second day. But those first two times are the most likely to lead to a pregnancy. So I mentioned earlier that we are joined by Dr. Hugo Fernandez. I'm going to invite him up to take you through the next couple of tips. I would just like to remind you all that we're very, very pleased to answer all of your questions at the end of the session. We will get to them all, and there are various ways of sending us through your questions. One is by using the Vimeo app. So if you see that there's a comment section or a Q&A section, enter your question in there. Otherwise, you can email us at newlife@newlifeivf.com.au and we will get to your questions at the end. I'll pass over to Hugo now.
Thanks for that, Chris. Some great tips there to help improve fertility. I'm going to take you through the next couple of tips. The main one being on tubes, uterus and ovary, so the anatomy. I say that my job's pretty easy because there's only three things that I have to do. I have to make sure you have eggs, sperm, and number three is that the plumbing is working. So Chris has just covered the eggs, and we're going to cover plumbing right now. So why do we check, or how do we check that the plumbing is actually working? At its easiest or most straightforward way is we just take some take a history and ask some questions. Often your symptoms and your presentation will give us a lot of information about what could possibly be going wrong. So, for instance, if you present with abnormal bleeding, say heavy periods, I may think, you know, do you have a polyp or do you have some fibroids? If you have pain with intercourse, I may think, do you have some adhesions or do you have endometriosis? If you've previously had an infection, I may think, well, is the tubes blocked? If you've got a mass or something feeling abnormal on palpation, I may think, do you have fibroids? Is your uterus bigger than normal? Do you have adenomyosis? So we can often work out what's going on by your symptoms and by having a feel of your abdomen. If we want to get a bit fancy, the next step would be to do an ultrasound. So an ultrasound is a great tool for giving us a lot of information. Whilst it's invasive, because for women it's normally done as a transvaginal ultrasound, an abdominal ultrasound will often provide a lot of information as well. If given the choice, or if asked before an ultrasound, really you should agree to a vaginal ultrasound, because it does give much more information and is of a higher quality. On ultrasound, they're looking at the uterus and the ovaries. Now, you don't have to get what I call a fancy ultrasound. You can get one done at the local one of the local providers, such as MIA. As long as we get a good sizing and shape of the uterus and we find two ovaries, that in itself tells us a lot of information, because often the anatomy being normal excludes a lot of pathology. Even things like saying that the tubes and ovaries are able to be moved around easily provides information, such as whether you have adhesions or endometriosis. If we suspect that maybe there is something wrong or we want further information, I often send my patients off for a fancy scan, which just means it gets done by a gynecologist specially trained in scanning. And essentially, they're just like me, but they just choose to scan all day. They provide much higher quality scans. Often it's a half hour to 45 minutes. They give a much better overview of the anatomy and any pathology. And the important thing is that because they're trained the same way that I am as a gynecologist, their brain is always thinking not only what is the pathology, but how does this relate to disease, as opposed to just saying that there's something wrong. An extension on that is to test your tubes. And tubal studies, there are various ways to do this. They usually involve pushing a liquid or an oil or some sort of foam through the cervix. It goes into the uterus and then should run out through the tubes and spill into the pelvis. There are different techniques to do this, but the whole point of them is to check that the liquid does run the whole way through, proving that the tubes are open. It doesn't really give an indication as to the quality of the tubes, but it does say that they're open, and that in itself is a lot of information. It also gives a better understanding of the shape of the uterus and whether there are any physical abnormalities or growths within the cavity. It's not the most pleasant of tests. I've never had a patient thank me for ordering that test, but certainly it does provide a lot of information. The next step up from that is obviously surgery. And with surgery, I mean a laparoscopy or keyhole surgery, where we put a camera through your belly button and have a look at the pelvis, or a hysteroscopy, where we put a really fine camera, about the thickness of a straw, through the cervix and look into the inside of the womb. Often these two are done together. So whilst people often associate a surgery with a treatment, it can actually also be a diagnostic procedure. I agree that it's a little bit more invasive than just a pelvic ultrasound, but it also provides a lot more information. We have a really thorough look around at both ovaries, the tubes. We do a tubal study, but within the pelvis. and within the operation. We have a look within the womb, so we get much closer views. If you've ever seen an ultrasound, you'll see that it's like a moving x-ray, so it's all black and white and shades. With a laparoscopy, you get direct views and you're able to directly visualise the anatomy. So it's not, could this be a polyp? It's, I'm looking at a polyp. Obviously, the surgery means that you can continue on and actually treat it at the same time if there is anything found. That said, even a diagnostic laparoscopy where we have a look around and we find absolutely nothing wrong with you is of benefit. It's a benefit, one, because it's a big tick to say, look, there's actually nothing wrong, and we certainly don't need to surgically fix you. This is going to be a hormonal problem or something that can be managed through IVF. But number two, if we don't find, even in patients where we find nothing wrong, the actual process of undertaking a curette, doing a flush, flushing out the uterus and flushing out the tubes, which often have mucus and other gunk in them, just that process of doing the procedure often lifts the chances of natural fertility for the next couple of months. So what do we want? Well, we don't want a uterus or plumbing that looks like this. We want a uterus that looks like this. What we don't want is one that looks like this. So this is endometriosis with an endometrioma on that ovary. And endometriosis is an inflammatory condition where some of the lining has ended up in the pelvis. And it causes infertility through inflammation and by the ability to distort anatomy. We don't want ovarian cysts. So there's many different types of ovarian cysts and they cause grief in various ways. But really over time, as they get bigger, they have a tendency to cause pain. They can cause the anatomy to twist and they can twist the ovaries, leading to lower egg count and also almost to the point of killing the ovary and it may need to be removed. There's a type of ovarian cyst associated with endometriosis called an endometrioma. They affect fertility because as they grow, they not only have the risk of causing the ovary to twist, but they're actually destroying ovarian tissue. And as we know, ovaries are made up of eggs. So as it grows, it actually is destroying ovarian tissue, destroying eggs, and lowering your chances of success. A hydrosalpinx is a fancy name that we give for a swollen blocked tube. In this case, it means that it's blocked and has been filled with water or the liquid that your body secretes. It's usually a sign that there's been some sort of inflammation, can sometimes occur because of endometriosis or a previous infection, and essentially it just means that the tube has been blocked and the liquid has been building up and can't escape. The reason that this is not good, it means obviously that the tube is blocked, which is bad for the passage of an egg and sperm. But the second reason is that the liquid that's in a hydrosalpinx, whilst it's a normal liquid that your body produces, if it stays there, it becomes stagnant, for better want of a better term. And that liquid is actually going to decrease your chances of fertility. And in fact, in IVF, it halves the chance of the embryo taking by just being there. So in IVF, if we detect one of these before putting an embryo back, we will either clip the tube or remove the tube because it will have a negative effect on our outcomes. Fibroids are benign growths that can occur in the walls of the uterus. They're really common and they're usually quite small, like the size of a pea. They become an issue when they start to push into the uterine cavity. When they do that, they distort the lining and make it harder for an embryo to implant. As they become bigger, to the size of, you know, oranges or even larger, to the size of, say, a cantaloupe or something, they have other issues by being a competition with any pregnancy for space within your pelvis. These can be managed surgically and are usually benign. Importantly, you should get onto them earlier rather than later. The later and larger they are, the harder they are to manage and the more trauma will cause to the uterus in operating. a polyp. So something as simple as a polyp, which is just a little skin tag, really, of the lining, can affect implantation. If you get pregnant naturally and you're known to have a polyp, that's not really an issue. You're pregnant and that's fantastic. However, if you have a known polyp, we wouldn't want to transfer an embryo knowing that, because we want the uterus to be as pristine as possible. So what can be done? As I alluded to earlier, laparoscopy or hysteroscopy, so one form of surgery or the other. All of these are sort of anatomical problems that really don't do very well with medication or tablets. They really do need surgical intervention. So tip number four, as I said, my job's pretty easy. We need plumbing. Chris has already gone into eggs, so we're going to go on to sperm. They're the three things that my job involves. So why do we check the sperm? And main reason is because it takes two to tango. Sperm and eggs are the two things that create embryos, obviously. Why else we do it is because it's a pretty simple test. A guy can produce a sample at home, or some facilities such as our own lab have rooms where a guy can produce in private. Often this is a better way to do it, because the sperm is provided to our scientists within half an hour or so of it being produced, and it means we can read the results straight away. Sometimes it can take an hour or longer for samples to be brought in from home, and sperm unfortunately starts to degenerate quite quickly. It's a common test to do. It's a pretty simple test to do, and it's very common, and often when mentioned there's a little bit of sniggering and giggling at the thought of this particular test. But the reality is, if you're going to have IVF or fertility treatment, you'll be producing samples in this manner reasonably common and reasonably, reasonably commonly. The last one is because the abnormal semen analysis can be corrected. So any sample that's produced really reflects how you've been over that day in the previous three or so months. So what do you do if there's any abnormalities? You repeat it. And the reason is that it reflects you over the last three or so months. You may have been unwell, you may have been sick, you may have been had COVID, you may have been vaccinated. Sperm are exquisitely sensitive to changes and to your health, and actually a good marker for your health. So in the first instance, if you have an abnormal test, short of it being zero, we get you to repeat it 2 to 3 months later. In the meantime, we try to correct some of the possible issues. We add some supplements, and we also go into some lifestyle changes. Chris is going to discuss some of the things that we can do to improve those, and I'll come back to some of the supplements later on to discuss both male and female supplements. Chris is going to go into some toxins and things that you should avoid.
Thank you, Hugo. Just in case you're wondering, we've got 10 tips to get through, and it's been fabulous so far. I hope you're enjoying it. Lots of questions coming in. Keep them rolling. But toxins flows on beautifully, because mostly when we test men, if we do find abnormalities, it is actually relatively unusual for us to find an underlying medical condition, which means we're kind of left with avoidance of things like toxins, and also diet and lifestyle type things as our most common treatment for improving a men's sperm results. But equally, just as like toxins can affect your sperm, they can also affect your eggs. So most of what I'm going to talk about here is applicable for both men and women. But basically, toxins that I'm going to talk about tonight can damage your eggs, they can damage your sperm, they can affect the way your fallopian tubes function, and they can also affect the makeup of your endometrial lining. So if the sperm does find the egg and it's good quality and your fallopian tubes are open, it still might have trouble implanting as a result of exposure to toxins. The most common toxin that we talk about, is very well studied, is smoking. So if you are smoking, you're exposing your eggs and your sperm to all sorts of things that can damage them. And as a result, we see quite marked reductions in pregnancy rates. So it's pretty simple. If you are smoking, you are definitely harming your chance of having a baby. And if you stop, you'll see dramatic increases in your chance of having a baby. So just by stopping smoking, you'll see a 65% chance in annual pregnancy rates. So it really is, out of all the things you could possibly do, stopping smoking is number one. And we definitely see similar results whether you are trying for a natural pregnancy or whether you are undergoing fertility treatment such as IVF. Other toxins we commonly talk about, alcohol is one that we talk about all the time, and certainly alcohol in high intake alcohol is certainly harmful, again, in the same ways that smoking is. One, if you keep to safe drinking limits, though, we don't really see much difference in your chance of having a baby. I get asked about caffeine a lot because we know that, for instance, 4 or 5 coffees a day will make it harder to conceive and increase the chance of miscarriage. Again, similar to alcohol, if you keep to relatively low intake levels, it's not harmful. So caffeine, you can sort of have 1 or 2 coffees a day without it affecting your fertility. Other things that you hear about if you delve in a little bit deeper are BPA plastic. So BPA is a type of plastic that goes into the manufacture of a lot of plastic bottles. So we generally recommend that you avoid drink bottles with BPA and BPB. So you'll see a lot of drink bottles with a sign saying BPA free, but for all we know, they might be made of BPB, which is as harmful as BPA. So best just to avoid plastic bottles altogether and get some aluminium or glass ones. Another way that you get exposed to BPAs is through receipts at the shops. So when they give you your FBOS receipt, or if you're at Coles and they give you your supermarket receipt, you know how it's that shiny sort of plasticky, papery stuff, that's got a plastic coating on it that's quite high in BPA. And some studies were done on sales assistants who handle these papers quite frequently, and it was found that they have quite high systemic levels of BPA, so that's a little bit of a worry. So next time they say, do you want your receipt, say no thank you. Pesticides and herbicides are an obvious one. They can accumulate in your ovaries, as can heavy metals, and the latest thing that everyone's talking about is nanoparticles. So do your best to avoid nanoparticles. That's another talk. We won't get into that tonight. But in terms of herbicides and pesticides, best way to avoid that is to either buy organic vegetables and fruit or just give them a really good wash before you eat them. I've cheekily added sugar to the list because I must admit I'm a bit of a sugar Nazi, and I'm firmly of the belief that sugar is a toxin, which moves us on to our next topic, which is tip number 6, improve your diet and start exercising. And similarly to stopping smoking, if you look at body mass index in women and how that correlates with their chance of getting pregnant, we see much higher pregnancy rates in women who have a BMI in the healthy range. So if you have a look at this chart, it shows that a woman's chance to get pregnant in a year might be 90%. So this is obviously a young, fit, healthy population, 90% chance in a year. If you are of a BMI 25 to 30, it drops by 5%. If your BMI is greater than 30, it drops by about 10%. So therefore, you can get good increases in pregnancy rates by getting yourself into that healthy weight range. Similarly for men, we see good good fertility rates when they're in the normal weight range of 20 to 25. Interestingly, men have the biggest drop-off by being underweight, and that's usually because if men are underweight, their sperm production drops. As they get overweight, though, whilst the sperm count might be okay, we do start seeing more damage to the sperm, we see more abnormal sperm, and as a result, that inhibits the sperm's ability to fertilise the egg. So again, men can get into the normal weight range and they will see better pregnancy rates for their partners. And in fact, as you can see on the chart there, you can see a 40% increase in pregnancy rates by normalising your body mass index. From a diet point of view, I do recommend a low sugar diet. There's lots of evidence suggesting that but that increasing your that having an increased sugar intake will make you insulin resistant, and that inhibits your ability to ovulate. There's also some recent data looking at the effect of insulin resistance on the endometrial lining, and we definitely see abnormalities in the makeup of your endometrial lining if you are hyperinsulinemic or if you are insulin resistant. So as a result, I really do recommend a very low sugar diet, and by extension a low carbohydrate diet. Now, everyone gets a little bit confused by that. When I say low carbohydrate, I'm really talking about refined carbohydrates like pasta and bread and all those delicious things that we love. I'm not really talking about leafy vegetables, which are clearly a carbohydrate but clearly very healthy. A grey area is things like fruit. Fruit is, you know, somewhat healthy, but it's very high in sugar, so I tend to recommend low sugar fruits such as berries rather than high sugar fruits such as oranges and bananas. And by extension, juice is just absolutely out. It's so high in sugar and has very little nutritional value. Talking about exercise, if you're someone who doesn't exercise, the most benefit you will ever get is to go from not exercising to doing any form of exercise at all. So if that means going for a walk for 5 minutes a day, that will benefit you. You'll get more benefit from 5 minutes of exercise than someone who exercises a lot. So if you exercise, you know, 4 hours a week, going up by 5 minutes is not going to make any difference. But if you are essentially exercise naive, just a little bit of exercise will make a big difference. So given that anything is beneficial, what's the most beneficial? The most beneficial is probably things like high-impact interval training. F45 is a good example of that. Maybe if you're really good at walking, you can introduce a little bit of jogging during your walk. I don't suggest that you go for a 45-minute jog, for instance. That's a relatively inefficient way to exercise. But if you spend your 45 minutes walking, then jogging for a minute, then resting by walking, then jogging for a minute, by doing that really high intensity up and down, that's where you get your most benefit, as well as with weight training. Now, weight training doesn't have to be going to the gym. It can be doing squats, it can be doing push-ups, it can be doing planks and things like that. Things that you can do easily around the home. You don't have to go anywhere, and you don't have to waste your time driving to the gym. You don't have to waste your money on a gym membership to do those things. So now we're off to talk to my good friend Hugo again, and he's going to talk. We've had some questions about supplements already, so they'll be covered in this little next little segment.
Again, excellent tips there, Chris. And moving on to the next two tips. I'm up tip 7 on supplements. So it seems that supplements are everywhere in our society now, and everyone seems to be on one or another thing. And part of that's because we lead really busy lives. We don't do much exercise. A lot of other food that we take is quick food and not necessarily the healthiest. So this is a way to get around it and some of the things that are missing from our bodies. So the first question I have is what are you trying to achieve when you're taking supplements? And often patients will come in and they'll be on different supplements because they read it somewhere on a blog or Facebook, or a friend said that they should take something. And it's important to differentiate between prenatal and fertility supplements. So a prenatal supplement is something that you take, similar to a daily multivitamin, that you take to replace what your body needs as a background, but to some of the minerals and vitamins that your body needs in order to assist the growth of a baby. And a prenatal supplement is something that women should be on for about 2 to 3 months before they intend to get pregnant, and they should continue throughout the length of pregnancy. Quite often, people don't start a prenatal supplement until the second or third month of their pregnancy, because they're either not trying to get pregnant or they don't know that they're pregnant until then. Ideally, you would start that before trying to get pregnant. A fertility supplement is something you take to help with fertility. It's often similar chemicals and vitamins or products that are in an antenatal product. but they're being taken for different reasons. So sperm and eggs are cells, just like any other cell in the body. It needs various vitamins and minerals to assist with growth. Some of these vitamins and minerals are associated with hormones as well, which are required for the fertility pathway. So we know that if you're low in some of these, they can affect reproduction and fertility. So you take a fertility supplement to help get pregnant. Once you're pregnant, you can stay on an antenatal supplement. What's important to know is that natural and organic does not necessarily mean that it's better. It usually means that the price is higher, but many products, vitamins, occur in food naturally. Whether they're produced in a factory or whether they're sort of extracted somehow from food, they're the same chemical. The best way to take these supplements on board, as Chris said, is just to eat properly and have lots of vegetables usually will replace a lot of these. But natural or organic doesn't necessarily mean better. In the same way, the adage that if a little bit is good, then more must be better, this is not true. Usually, there's a limit to which what your body can absorb or requires of each product. Above this, you can take more. If your body doesn't need it, you're just going to pee it out. And in doing so, you're actually just wasting money. The follow-on from this is that natural organic doesn't make it safe. So taking more can actually be quite unsafe in some in regards to some vitamins and chemicals. And just because it's natural or organic doesn't make it safe. You can still get very unwell. So if we move on just onto prenatal supplements, here are a couple of the common products. If you go online and do a search for these, there's thousands. In fact, you can almost be a specialist just in supplements. Fabfol there in the corner is probably the simplest with only four things in it, and then the other two have anywhere from a dozen to 15 different products. But those four products are probably the most common and the most important. Folic acid being important for spinal cord development, vitamin D for bone development, iodine for thyroid and neural development, and iron obviously we know is a part of hemoglobin. Women often have low iron because they have periods. They're often washed out, and if you're washed out and tired, imagine being pregnant and washed out. So they're the four or so supplements that you should look for in an antenatal product. Fertility-wise, there's a whole list. These first four are what we call antioxidants. So the role of an antioxidant is to mop up these things called free radicals that are molecules that float around in our bodies and can attack cells and DNA causing breakdown. So coenzyme Q10 found in mitochondria. Melatonin is one of the chemicals in our brains that help us fall asleep. All very sort of common products and can be bought over the counter actually just at a from a pharmacy in the sort of in the supplements section. Any of these are really, really good at improving fertility, and they all sort of work in a very similar way. These other products work in different areas. Vitamin D, for instance, is important for bone development, but as a fertility supplement, it's also been shown to improve egg and sperm quality. Zinc is often associated with sperm development. Inositol is a product that's often used by women with PCOS and has been shown to help reduce insulin resistance, which is one of the main issues of PCOS. And can actually help people start to ovulate more regularly. And DHEA or androgen are more commonly, I suppose, called, you know, the male hormone, although women do have these in their body as well. And these have been associated with better and higher quality eggs and sperm. Of these products, the ones that have just gone bold, so coenzyme Q10, vitamin C, vitamin E, and vitamin D are probably the most important. Why? Well, they're pretty easy to get your hands on. Most chemists, as I said, will have these. They're pretty cheap. They can be taken as a supplement, or you can absorb a lot of these just through eating properly. The ones with the little male next to them are the ones that are probably best for guys to take to help with sperm quality. So my normal advice to guys is, or to both, is to jump on some coenzyme Q10, so 600 milligrams each. And then if you just take a normal multivitamin, you should be able to get some C, E, and zinc. Tip number 8, see a fertility specialist. So when do you see a fertility specialist? Well, you obviously see one when there's an obvious problem. The most obvious problem is if you have an irregular cycle. If, as Chris alluded, if your cycle is irregular, it usually means that you're either not ovulating or you're ovulating at the wrong time. And so it's really hard to get pregnant if you don't know when the sperm's meant to meet the egg. If there are any other problems, such as the ones that I mentioned on ultrasound, such as masses or growths or abnormal bleeding, they're all the reasons that you should see a fertility specialist. The next one is it's age-based. So if you're finding it hard to get pregnant and you're getting older, the chances are that the success is going to fall over time. So the older you are, the more likely you should get in to see a specialist sooner rather than later, so that we can maximise your chances. And then the last one is really to ask yourself, how big a family do you want to have? If it's hard to have one child, it's going to be harder to have two or three. And just sort of by way of information, you have about an 80% chance of having one child if you start from about 37 years old onwards. But if you want to have an 80% chance of having two children, you need to have started by about 34. And if you want to have an 80% chance of having three children, you really need to start trying to conceive from about age 30. So thinking about the family that you want, how long it takes to have a child, that the fact that you'll have a child, you then need to raise a baby, and a lot of people don't want to start until at least 6 months to 12 months after having that child. So you're going to have to spread out having children over a few years, and all along your fertility is falling. So what do fertility specialists do? Well, we give you a personalised assessment. This is all we do every day. So rather than general information, we take history from both male and female and sort of zone in on the reasons why usually both people are contributing to the lack of fertility. With that, we can then personalise your plan. We personalise it by establishing the different factors in your age and giving you an estimate of the chances of getting pregnant either naturally or through IVF. And I often give my patients a number of this is your chances of having a natural pregnancy. If we do IVF, these are your chances. If you do get pregnant, this is your chances of a miscarriage. And then the last one, here's your chances of having a genetic abnormality. All information that helps you make decisions. A fertility specialist will also have access to a laboratory, either to do testing. So I know I often send guys for a semen analysis at my own lab because I know it's really high quality and it can feed into the IVF treatment with the information that we gain. But the second one is fertility specialists will usually have access to IVF treatments, which unless you have a dedicated lab that is high quality where you can interact with the staff and the scientists to really work together, it will make any fertility treatment harder to achieve. So speaking of fertility treatment, I think we're going to go into tip 9 and 10, which are IUI and IVF. So, Chris?
Thank you, Hugo. So everything we've talked to you about up until this point has been things that will help you to get pregnant naturally without any laboratory treatments. Of course, all of those things will feed into increased success rates if you do need fertility treatments such as IUI or IVF. So all very good information regardless of what stage you're up to in your fertility journey. IUI is a process where we get sperm from the male partner or from a donor, and we prepare that sperm in the laboratory. And that's and what we do when we prepare the sperm is we get rid of all the rubbish that's in semen, all the white cells, all the crap, and we just get highly concentrated sperm that is swimming in the right direction. So all the immotile sperm is filtered out as well. And then we get that very small, tiny volume, a tiny little droplet of highly concentrated sperm, and we pass that sperm into through your cervix and into your uterus. And this must be done in conjunction with some sort of testing to figure out when you're ovulating. We don't just put it in there any day of the week. We've already gone over tonight when the most fertile times are. So we take that into account when we're timing our IUI procedures. Now, just going back a step, I didn't even mention, we just called it IUI. But IUI stands for intrauterine insemination. And so usually we have to get you, you either have to ovulate naturally, or you have to be someone who we can help ovulate with some medications. And really how ovulation, how IUI works is that, you know, usually when you're having sex at home, the sperm's ending up at the vault of the vagina, just below the cervix. So we're helping the sperm through the cervix. Now, sometimes the cervix is a little bit obstructive, either because of anatomical issues, it's a bit tight, or because the mucus within your cervix is a little bit hostile towards the poor little sperms that are trying to get through. So if we introduce the sperm into your uterus, we're getting them just a little bit closer to the egg so that the egg can be fertilised naturally. And then a natural pregnancy occurs and it moves into your uterus, and then the rest, as they say, is history. So I guess the question about IUI is, why would you do it? Is it successful? And what I often take my patients through is this little table here. Now, this is from a website called yourfertility.org.au. It's a it's put together by VARTA, which is the Victorian Assisted Reproductive Treatment Authority. It's a bit of a mouthful. And so it's an independent body that oversees reproductive treatment in Victoria. And what you can do is, if you've been trying for a pregnancy for 12 months or longer, you can plug your little variables into this little calculator. And for the benefits of an example, I've said that the patient in this circumstance is 38 years old, that she's been trying for a baby for 12 months. Her partner has had a sperm test, and his motility, so the number of sperm swimming, is 50%, and I've said that she's never gotten pregnant before. Now, this also assumes that she ovulates, and it assumes that she's got fallopian tubes, both of which are open and not blocked, and the sperm test is otherwise completely normal. So normal concentration, normal, a decent number of normal appearing sperm. And then when you input those variables, you get chance of getting pregnant with various treatments. And if you look at the bottom of the sheet, it's showing that if you continue without any treatment, your chance of getting pregnant over the next 12 months, if you were this woman, is 23%. So if you sort of crudely divide 23 into 12, that means your chance of getting pregnant is about 2% per month, which is rather low, you'd all agree. It also tells us that after 12 months, you know, 23% chance you will be pregnant, 77% chance you won't be. It's pretty underwhelming statistics. So therefore, what you might consider, as we are now, is IUI. So how good is IUI? Now, IUI will offer this same woman a 31% chance of pregnancy. So fairly similar to 23%, a slight increase, but what you've got to remember is these IUI figures are based on 6 months of IUI, whereas the natural pregnancy rates of 23 were based on 12 months of trying. So you get slightly higher pregnancy rates in 6 months with IUI than what you will get in 12 months of trying naturally. It's always imperative to compare these pregnancy rates to IVF as well. And yourfertility.org has done some calculations and suggested that this woman would get pregnant, her chance of getting pregnant would be 46% if she had two embryo transfers. So again, the pregnancy rates are considerably higher for IVF compared to IUI, plus you've got to remember that that treatment takes place over 2 months instead of six. So that's a really important thing to consider. So as a result, you'd have to conclude from this that IUI is more successful at getting you pregnant than trying naturally, although less successful than IVF, which of course is tip number 10. Now, talking about IVF is a whole talk in of itself. And if you are subscribers to our YouTube channel, last year we recorded a webinar where we went through the process of IVF in quite a lot of detail. We've talked about genetic testing in detail. We've talked about recurrent IVF failure in detail. So this is going to be the 2 minute version talking about the IVF process. We've also got an update to the IVF just to bring it up to date for 2022 in a couple of months as part of our webinar series. But so IVF in essence is where we get a woman to produce lots of eggs all at once, and we do that by giving her a combination of injections that make the eggs that exist within her ovary mature. And during that time that she's taking the injections, the time period is around about 10 to 12 days of injections. During that time, we do blood tests and ultrasounds to see how it's tracking. And then we plan to do an operation called an egg collection, which is the picture that's up on the screen at the moment. And what it's showing you is that for an egg collection to take place, we normally have the woman asleep in our operating theatre. We do an internal ultrasound and we pass a very fine needle through the top of her vagina and into her ovary. And using that very fine needle, we can very safely retrieve the eggs that we have grown in the preceding 10 days. We've grown them by having her on some injections. We're able to retrieve those eggs and get them out of her ovaries. As Hugo very rightly identified, it takes two to tango, so we then need some sperm. And there's a couple of ways of putting the sperm with the egg, but the basic way is what we call conventional IVF. And in that situation, we pour a droplet of sperm. You probably don't pour a droplet, do you? But you place a droplet of sperm together with the egg. And if you have a look at this picture here, you can see a nice, beautiful egg there, and it's surrounded by the eggshell, which is a collection of cells that nourish and protect the egg. And you can see some tiny little sperm that if this was a video, you'd see them swimming around. And what those sperm are trying to do is trying to break their way through the eggshell. Hugo's laughing at me. They're trying to break their way through the eggshell and get into the egg and fertilise it. So the eggs get fertilised outside of your body in the laboratory. We then have to grow the fertilised eggs for 5 days. Now, if we collect 10 eggs from a woman, for instance, firstly, they don't all fertilise. Secondly, they don't all grow normally. But the ones that are able to grow for 5 days in our embryoscope are good quality embryos that have a good chance of getting you pregnant. And what we do is pick, on the 5th day after egg collection, we pick one good-looking embryo and we place that into your uterus. And the way we do that, it's very straightforward. You're awake for this procedure. It's not particularly uncomfortable. If you can tolerate a pap smear, you can tolerate an embryo transfer. But we place a very, very fine tube through your cervix and we gently deposit the embryo at the top of your uterus. And then about 10 days after that, you do a pregnancy test to see if it's worked. So from first injection to pregnancy test is all done in about 4 weeks. So it's quite a quick procedure as well. We always hope when we do IVF that as well as having the embryo that we transfer into uterus, that we have additional embryos left over that can be frozen. And they can be frozen to be used later. And when I say later, that could be if that embryo that goes in initially does not get you pregnant, the next month we thaw out the next one for you. Or if you do get pregnant and have a baby, we might have a couple of embryos in storage so that when you want to have another baby, we don't have to go through all this IVF again. We can just thaw out your embryo and put it in your uterus at the precise right time, and you might be able to have another baby using those original embryos. So that is IVF in 5 minutes. And I'm sure anyone who hasn't been through IVF has lots of questions, and I would direct you to our previous webinars about that. And it's interesting because when IVF started, it was a bit of a Hail Mary, it was a bit of a prayer, and that was back in the 80s, and pregnancies were very rare. But now there's almost not a single person who wouldn't have improved pregnancy rates by doing IVF. So what I mean by that is if you compare pregnancy rates trying naturally versus IVF, at almost any age, IVF is superior. The question, though, is, do you need IVF? And of course, we're not advocating that if you're 30 years old and you're just starting out to try, that you come in and do IVF because it works quicker. It's probably not the right thing to do. It's probably better to try naturally for a period of time. But I guess the difficult question for most people, once they've been trying to get pregnant for a little while, is when to do IVF. And that is a really difficult question to answer. And that's where I take patients back to that original calculator that I was showing you at yourfertility.org.au. is that if you consider the chance of getting pregnant over a period of time naturally versus other treatments such as IUI versus IVF, you can only make a personalised decision based on your personal situation. So I can't tonight tell you who needs to have IVF and who doesn't. That's a very personalised thing. And again, going back to Hugo, what was Hugo was saying about seeing a fertility specialist, what you should be expecting from your fertility specialist is a personalised, tailored plan. They shouldn't be doing for you what they do for everyone else. It really should be specific to your situation. The other question is, where should you do IVF? And of course, I'm biased. I'm from New Life IVF. So of course, I'm going to say that you should be doing it with us. But rather than do that, I'll just take you through some of the things you should be really looking at in choosing an IVF provider. And the biggest one, I think, which I'm going to go into a little bit of detail, is are they up to date? And it might surprise you that some of the most expensive providers in Melbourne are still using relatively old technology to provide their treatment. And so I'll come back and talk about that a little bit more. Attention to detail is really important. If you get a sense that a fertility specialist is glossing over things, is not explaining things well, it generally that's something you really want to avoid. But also in the laboratory, it couldn't be more important. And when we set up our laboratory at New Life IVF, it's only been up for about 2 years, and the amount of detail that went into the planning, right down to the colour of the lights. So we don't have normal lights in the lab. We filter out all the blue light spectrum because we know that that damages sperm and eggs and embryos. So little things like that, that's what I mean when I say attention to detail. Unfortunately, it's really difficult as a patient to try and get through that, but these are some of the things you need to consider. The involvement of your specialist is really important. Again, you want to make sure that your procedures are being performed by really well-trained, high-volume specialists. So if you're having an embryo transfer for someone who's not a fertility specialist, or someone who does one or two embryo transfers a month because they're not particularly high volume, we know that that leads to lower pregnancy rates. Really important is cost, because expensive does not necessarily mean better. And when we sort of put through, when we put New Life IVF together, we weren't aiming to be cheap, we weren't aiming to be expensive. All we did was design the best laboratory we could possibly design and have the best fertility specialists, the best nurses we could get, the best embryologists. And that's how we did it. And then we looked at how what pricing we could offer that to patients. And so I think, you know, the number of treatment cycles you're able to get through is very cost determinant. One of the things that's really important when assessing IVF fees, though, is to understand the inclusions. And that's where I'm sort of coming back to, are the laboratories up to date? Because when we designed the lab, we just said, what is best practice? We'll put it in. And if there's some sort of laboratory treatment or some sort of equipment that leads to better pregnancy rates across the board for everyone, it is included as standard treatment by us. And the best example I can give you of that is the use of an embryoscope. And an embryoscope is a machine where once we've got your sperm and the eggs together in the laboratory, we then put your fertilised eggs or your embryos into our embryoscope, and that's where they stay for 5 days. And the important thing about that is that your embryos are kept at the perfect temperature, they are kept at the perfect concentration of oxygen, the perfect concentration of carbon dioxide. We know that variables, if you take an embryo out of an embryoscope or out of its incubator, the temperature of that embryo drops, and that really does affect the embryo. So if you're able to keep it inside, that's obviously the ideal scenario. We're able to keep the embryo inside the embryoscope because it's got microscopes built in inside it. So we can assess the embryo very, very effectively without having to move it. By contrast, what a lot of laboratories use is old-fashioned incubators such as this. And this is called a mink incubator. And the embryos go into this little dish, you close the lid, and when you want to look at it under a microscope, you open the lid up, you expose the embryo to temperature changes, you expose it to oxygen, which is toxic to embryos, and you expose it to a lack of carbon dioxide, which is also detrimental. So these embryos are taken out of the incubator. The scientist will walk across the room to their microscope, pop it under the microscope, look at it for a minute or two, expose it to all those nasties in the atmosphere, and then they'll walk back and put it back in the embryo, in the incubator. So all of these things are avoided by using an embryoscope. And going back to cost, one of the things we said was that we would always offer best practice to everyone. A lot of companies don't have embryoscopes, but if they do, they generally charge you a lot more to use them. This is a little chart that shows your chance of pregnancy if you use a closed culture system, such as an embryoscope, versus an open culture system, such as a mink incubator. And you can see there is a very significant increase in the chance of you getting pregnant with an embryo transfer, 37% versus 44.9%. So that's a dramatic increase just by changing your practice and using the best culture techniques possible. So this brings me to talking about what are the success rates of at New Life IVF, and it's a really common question. And success rates are a very important measuring stick for how your IVF laboratory and how your fertility specialist and team of specialists are performing. And this is our pregnancy rates from the year up to, I believe, I think it was 2019. So inevitably with pregnancy rates from IVF, they do trail a little bit, because what we have to do is wait and see if the babies are born before we can know if our if our treatment's been successful. And all pregnancy rates with IVF are very much age dependent. It's much easier to get pregnant with IVF or naturally if you are younger compared to if you are older. And this shows the chance of getting pregnant with a single embryo transfer based on your age. And if you are less than 35, Our pregnancy rates are 47.5%. If you're 35 to 37, they're just a tick under 40. If you're 38 to 40, they're just a tick, they're just a touch over 38%. And once you're over 41, this includes women up to 45, but not past their 46th birthday, we get pregnancy rates of 23.6%. When we change that to live birth rate, you do see a slight drop off, and that's because some people unfortunately miscarry in early pregnancy and have losses. So our live birth rates are a little bit lower than our implantation rate or our positive pregnancy test rate. And you can see that at 35, about 40% live birth rate, about 33% for 35 to 37, 27 for 38 to 40s, and just under 14% for women over 41. So that brings us, we are just completely out of tips. We've got nothing more to add. But of course, you have sent through lots of great questions, and now we'll now start running through those. I'm going to take a few first, and then I'll hand over to Hugo. We've got lots of great questions. This shows we've got a very engaged audience. The first is, what supplements should I take before an egg collection? And I think Hugo's covered that off really nicely. This one is a bit of someone explaining the situation they're in, and she's told us that she's 39 years old with a low AMH, a small fibroid, and no other known structural issues. So interestingly, you've given us a lot of information that we were just talking about early as being important. Inconsistent cycles, so 29 to 35 day cycles, and not sure about ovulation, trying for a baby for 4 months, no male infertility factor, which I assume means a normal sperm test, and what should I be focused on moving forward to increase chances naturally? So hopefully we've given you a good grounding and on the things that we would recommend throughout the talk. And we have to always say that whenever we are talking about relatively specific questions like this, we have to tell you that we can't really comment on specific. We have to talk quite generally, and the only way you can get a specific answer is to see a fertility specialist and ask your specific questions. However, having said all that, the things I would be thinking about is, firstly, the fibroid, where is it growing? If it's growing on the outside of your uterus and it's small rather than the inside of the uterus, it's probably not a big deal, and I wouldn't be worried too much about that. With the irregular cycles, it does make it a little bit hard to be certain when you are ovulating. So with that in mind, it might be that you should consider some sort of tracking of ovulation, whether that's by blood tests or ultrasounds, or even whether you consider some ovulation induction treatment. such as Clomid or Letrozole, to bring the timing and make the timing of ovulation a little bit more consistent. That would be something that would be worth considering. I'm not sure if you've had your fallopian tubes checked. It's probably not imperative after 4 months of trying. However, if you are going to go to some considerable effort to get pregnant, like doing Clomid or Letrozole and cycle tracking, it might be prudent to check that your fallopian tubes are open and not blocked prior. And I guess the thing I would say, you've also mentioned you've got frozen eggs. That's fantastic. You're in a really good position if you've got frozen eggs, because you've always got that as something to fall back on. Of course, the success of frozen eggs really does depend on the number that you have frozen and the age you were at which when you were freezing them. But having said all that, it's great to have some frozen eggs. Next question I'm going to take is, after an embryo transfer or finding out I'm pregnant, how important is it to be careful with the amount of exercise that is performed? So traditionally, you know, advice about exercise during pregnancy was really very conservative, and women were encouraged to reduce exercise. They were told to monitor their heart rate, but there's actually no reason that that advice should be given. And I've done very thorough literature reviews and assessment of guidelines, and I can't find that advice is grounded in any facts whatsoever. So generally what I encourage my patients to do is that if you're someone who's exercised pre-pregnancy and exercised during your fertility treatment, I highly encourage you to keep going, because it has such significant benefits to your overall health. It has significant benefits for your fertility health and your reproductive health, and it has significant benefits during pregnancy. Now, you were asking about adjustments, and I'll come back to that. But exercise during pregnancy has been proven to reduce complications such as gestational diabetes, such as growth restriction, and really importantly, pelvic pain late in pregnancy is really common, but it's reduced if you keep your exercise up during, because it keeps your muscles strong and your pelvis secure. So I couldn't recommend exercise during pregnancy any more highly. Now, how should you adjust it? Now, if you're someone who's exercised before pregnancy, most women find that they're a little bit tired during the first trimester, and I recommend keep going with what you've been doing, but reduce the intensity or your level of exercise to about 85% of your usual capacity. So whether that's 85% of the time or 85% of the effort or both, doesn't really matter, but keep going at about 85%. You don't really need to change the type of exercise you're doing. People are often very worried, what if I do weights, is that going to cause problems? Of course not. It's not going to make the embryo or the baby fall out, I can promise you. There are some circumstances where you would need to discuss that with your obstetrician, but as a general rule, that's what I would be saying. And if you're someone who's never exercised before, there's never a better time to start than in the first trimester. And again, you might remember earlier in the talk I mentioned the most benefit you'll ever get from exercise is going from nothing to doing something. So to change from doing no exercise in pregnancy to doing a little bit of walking, a little bit of yoga, a little bit of Pilates, those types of things can be really, really beneficial. I wouldn't recommend you go from doing nothing to running 10Ks a day. Obviously, that's not going to be good for you. Won't affect your pregnancy, but yeah, you'll feel like rubbish the next day. So just gradually introduce your exercise like you would outside of pregnancy. So Hugo's got a few questions that he would now like to take.
Thanks for that, Chris. There's some great questions coming through, and also there were some great answers. And it's good to see that our tips have covered a lot of the things that are coming through, which means we're giving out some good advice. So one of the questions that I've got come in is, how do I increase my chances of ovulation? What if I'm not ovulating, especially if my periods are irregular? And this person says, I'm worried I might be getting periods without ovulating. So Chris sort of covered this early on with how we can work out whether you're ovulating or not. Essentially, for my patients, I just look at their cycle. And if you ask them, and a lot of women have actually been tracking their cycles on apps before they come and see us. So as long as they've We've got a sort of good calendar. Even without doing any hormone testing, without looking into anything sort of specific, if you have a nice regular cycle, most cycles are 28 days, but even if it's 32, but it occurs always on 32 plus or minus a day or so, and it occurs at that time every month, then even without doing any blood tests, I can almost guarantee that you're ovulating purely by the fact that your period is so regular. But if you're not ovulating, Chris has gone through some of the tests that we can do, mainly blood tests that we can do to check if you are or not. So she's got here, I may be worried that I'm getting periods without ovulating. So can that be occurring? And I said, and it can. So just because you have a period doesn't mean you ovulated. In fact, women who have irregular cycles will sort of by definition, the ovaries will produce hormone and that will make your lining thick. And unless you ovulate, that lining just continues to get thicker and thicker and thicker. And then at some point it can become so thick that it just breaks down and you get a bleed. Now that bleed isn't, it's a bleed, it's like a period, but it's not a true period. It's not because something hormonal has happened. It's because the lining became so thick that your body wanted to get rid of it. So the only way you know that you've ovulated and that's the period follows is if you do a day, what we call a day 21 progesterone. So you can actually do a blood test in the middle of the second half, hence day 21, although it doesn't need to be day 21. It can be, I normally say, sort of 19 to 24. If you do a blood test there, progesterone, and that's elevated, then you've ovulated that month. So if you're concerned that you're not ovulating, Chris has gone through this, but your first would be to undertake things like dietary change or exercise, things that are going to reduce your BMI, things that are going to reduce insulin resistance and get your hormones into a more normal level. Usually by doing that, 5% body weight loss, women will establish a normal cycle. But if that doesn't occur, then we have quite a few ways to help you out. Even without, remember, we're not IVF specialists, we're fertility specialists. So even without needing to get into a lab, just through our rooms, we can often get you ovulating through tablets. Clomid or letrozole are the two most common. Sometimes metformin, which is a diabetic medication, can be used. All of these trick the body essentially into ovulating. And we can then also tell you when the ideal time to have intercourse. So if you don't think you're ovulating correctly, go see a fertility specialist. And whilst waiting, maybe try to lose some weight. Another question that I've had is, I have focal adenomyosis. What can I do to best enhance my chances of a successful FET that does not involve downregulation? So some big words in there, and I'll sort of explain all of them. So a FET is a frozen embryo transfer. It's just sort of one of the acronyms that we use, and that just means putting an embryo back. A downregulation is a type of treatment that we use, which essentially means shutting down your hormones or pulling your hormone levels down. And then there's adenomyosis. So adenomyosis is a sort of tricky condition to explain. It's one that many people don't know about. Endometriosis is something that people are very familiar with because it's got a lot of publicity in the community, and it's also quite widespread through the community. So in endometriosis, the lining, so the inside of the uterus that grows every month to hold an embryo and then carry a pregnancy, you get a period when that breaks down. In endometriosis, that tissue has made it into the pelvis and embedded into the walls of the pelvis. And because it stays there, it causes inflammation, and that inflammation is not good for eggs and sperm, decreases fertility, causes pain and scarring, so it twists and distorts the anatomy, and that's why endo is bad for fertility. Adenomyosis is or like a sister condition. In adenomyosis, the same thing has happened, but that lining, instead of going into the pelvis, it's actually invaded into the walls of the uterus. And the uterus is just a big muscle. So those same events, the inflammation, the bleeding, the pain, that's all occurring in the muscle of the uterus. And so what we think is that the uterus becomes really inflamed, and you can think that that's probably not the best environment for an embryo to be growing in. Now, there's no no big study that proves this, because it's a really hard study to undertake. However, we actually published a good study about 6 months ago looking at this, and there have been quite a few studies showing that patients who have adenomyosis do find it harder to get pregnant. Often they have endo as well, so we're not sure which one is having the negative effect, but adeno does seem by itself to make it harder to get pregnant, and we think it's because of the inflammation. And if you do get pregnant, unfortunately, you have a higher miscarriage rate. Again, we think because of the inflammation. The good news, I suppose, is that even though those pregnancy rates are, we found sort of about 25% lower than normal, if you're able to get pregnant and go past about 10 or so weeks, your pregnancy is no different to anyone else's, and the outcomes are the same. So it's really just getting you pregnant and through those first few weeks. So some of the treatments that have been suggested are a downregulation. And what that means is if we create your embryos and stimulate your uterus and stimulate all the disease, that's probably not the best environment to be putting an embryo back. So we separate the process, we create your embryos, freeze them, and then give you a bit of a break and some time off. And then we use a thing called downregulation to calm your pelvis down. And a downregulation is either an injection, usually, that's used, or an implant, and it essentially makes you menopausal. It switches off all the hormones in your reproductive tract. And as a result, you don't get a period for the 2 or 3 months that you're on it. But the good news is, if we switch off your hormones, then there's no period, there's no inflammation, and we're trying to get your body calm and get your pelvis calm, your uterus, I say we're putting your uterus to sleep. And as a result, we think that inflammation goes away. And after about 2 months, the uterus is essentially about as similar as it's going to be to a normal uterus. And it's at that point that we put the embryo back. So we put the embryo back on a quiet, non-inflamed uterus. So that's sort of the question, the process, and how we get around it. In this particular case, the patient talks about focal adenomyosis, which means instead of this inflammation and disease being throughout all the walls of the uterus, it's in a very specific spot. And this is a special type of adenomyosis, and it's not very common. The treatment, whilst you can use downregulation, and that's the most common treatment, they're saying, what are the other options? So there aren't a huge number of other options, and certainly nothing that has a study proving that it works, because these other options are not very common. So the first one is surgery. Because of the fact that the adeno is in a very specific area, it's not involving the entire uterus, and it has sort of very distinct or more distinct margins than normal, you are able to go in and remove just that bit of the uterus. Now, that may sound sort of very dramatic, but we do that anyway when you have fibroids. So a fibroid is a growth within the wall of the uterus, and you can actually go in, just remove the fibroid. Obviously, that leaves a defect in the uterus, but then part of the skill is in reconstructing the walls of the uterus. Often, in fact, focal adeno and fibroids are confused for one another on an ultrasound. Because it is focal, you can do the same procedure. It's not quite like doing the removal of a fibroid because the borders are not quite as obvious, but that is certainly a known technique. Interestingly, it's done a lot in Asian countries, and Japan is the main place. Probably 90% of articles come out of Japan, and they do this type of surgery a lot. There's no proof that it works, and it's a pretty invasive and pretty full-on surgery, and certainly there's no proof that your fertility outcomes are any better. The other way that this can be treated is with a thing called Mr. G-Fuss, or focused ultrasound. So in this instance, we know that ultrasound, which I described earlier, is a way to look at anatomy, and we use it through IVF to know where to put embryos, etc. So ultrasound is just sound waves, which by themselves are not dangerous. But if you focus sound or ultrasound waves to a specific point, that point becomes hot and heats up. In Mr. G-Fuss, which stands for MRI guided focused ultrasound, what they do is do an MRI of your pelvis, map out the uterus, map out where the fibroid is. They then sort of lock you into the machine so that you can't move around, and they use a special computer pen to circle where the fibroid, or in this case the adenomyoma, is. They circle it and they say, this is where we want all the ultrasound to go, and they focus ultrasound just to that point. And in doing so, it essentially cooks the fibroid. When it cooks, the tissue becomes sort of mush, and then over time the body will absorb it. So I spoke to a friend of mine who offers this treatment, and we've discussed this before as a treatment. It does work in the same way that it works for fibroids, but it's got limited scope. Normally it's only for smaller lesions. The lesions have to be pretty accessible, so if they're in the front of the uterus, closer to your abdomen, to your skin, then that's probably going to get a better outcome than one in the back of the uterus, because the sound waves have to travel through your skin, through the uterus, all the way to that lesion. Also, the bigger the lesion is, the more energy that's required, the more time you're going to have to spend in the machine, the longer it will take to cook, and you may require multiple treatments. It's also not funded by Medicare, so there's a sizable cost. That said, it's not invasive, and there have been pregnancies following this type of treatment. So it's certainly something to keep an eye on, as a possible non-invasive treatment. But the mainstay, certainly for most adenomyosis, because most adenomyosis is not in one location, the mainstay is still downregulation, and it's actually quite effective. I have one sort of further question. It's a different question, different patient. So this patient asks, it says, could azoospermia without a known cause be fixed or treated? One of the examples they say, such as lifestyle. So the questions are a little bit confusing. So I'll answer the question I think you're sort of asking. So again, some fancy words in here. Azoospermia means no sperm, is essentially the definition. So not even a few sperm, it just means no sperm. There are two main ways that you can have no sperm. So the first way is that there's some sort of blockage. So you're able to produce sperm, but it doesn't come out. And so when we look at a semen sample, we'll have liquid, because that occurs after the testes. We'll have a liquid in there, but there's actually no sperm swimming around. So that's called obstructive, because of an obstruction. And that's often because you've had a vasectomy. That's the most common. But also if you've had an infection, or if in some genetic conditions, patients with cystic fibrosis, for instance, can have this issue. In the other group is called non-obstructive. So non-obstructive azoospermia means that all the plumbing is there, but the sperm isn't. Now, that can either occur because the cells that create sperm aren't working, or because of the signals that tell the cells to work aren't working. It's really important to work out what the cause is, because some are treatable and some are not. So if you have an obstruction, then we may not be able to get around the obstruction, but we can do an operation. It's actually not a big operation. It often just involves a needle, and we can get a sample of sperm from the testy, which we use, and it's a reasonably common procedure and really successful for IVF. And this is, say, one of the treatments available to people who have had a vasectomy. If it's more a failure of hormones or a failure of the actual cells, then things get tricky. And if there's a genetic issue, things get tricky, because it's actually quite hard to... certainly if the cells are destroyed, the testes never formed properly, you had some injury when you were younger, if there was a twist or a torsion and sort of a lack of blood supply to the to the testes, those kind of things you really can't get around. If there's a chronic deficiency of hormone, often that's really hard to get around. Some things are able to. Some guys, who, for instance, who use steroids will often have really, really... may have had normal sperm, may have even had children, but the steroids lead to a shrinking of the testy, the actual ball, and also a significant derangement of the hormones that would push the creation of sperm. When they stop the steroids, it can take months to even years for that to reverse. For one, the normal hormone pathways to kick back in to create sperm, but then also for the testy to increase back to a more normal size. So some of those things can be reversed either by just letting nature do its thing and recover naturally, but can also be done by giving injections of hormones. But there are many circumstances where it's not able to be reversed. Luckily, if you do have azoospermia and it's not one of the things that we can get around, you can still have children. So you can use donor sperm. And New Life IVF has a sperm bank, and which is accessible to all our patients. And there may be a donor there that is suitable to you and your family. Other options include the use of sperm from friends, or if you want someone to be sort of genetically related to you, you could use your brother or even your father's sperm. So you can still get pregnant. It just may not be your sperm. But underlying all this, it really is important to try to work out what the underlying causes, or certainly what type of azoospermia you have. So I think I'll get Chris back. I think he's got some questions to follow on with, and keep them coming. Keep them coming through.
Thank you, Hugo. Just trying to figure out which questions we've answered and which ones we haven't. Right. So what are the chances of me getting pregnant at 40 years of age? And I assume that this question means is talking about getting pregnant naturally. The other thing we must assume is that you're ovulating, that you've got open fallopian tubes, you've got a normal uterus, and you've got normal sperm. And if it's all those things and you're just starting out now, the chance of pregnancy is probably about 3 or 4% per month. If, however, you've been trying for a little while, and if you've been trying for, say, 12 months, it's probably at about 2% per month chance that you'll get pregnant naturally. My age is 38 years old. Do I need to freeze my eggs, or do I freeze my eggs? And I think if you're 38, it's important to have a baby, and you're not in the position to have a baby now for whatever reason, I think it's incredibly important that you seriously consider freezing your eggs, because you will get dramatically higher pregnancy rates using eggs retrieved today and used in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years than you will ever get by trying to get pregnant with your eggs when you are older. So I think you should seriously consider it. It really does come down to some specific things like how many eggs do you have and what are your expectations. But I'd be talking to a fertility specialist about that quite soon. Do we recommend delaying an embryo transfer if you recently got COVID? If you had COVID recently and you recovered, I wouldn't delay it. If you had COVID recently, you've still got symptoms. As long as you're not febrile, it's okay to have the embryo transfer. And I think that covers all of our questions. And Hugo's just showing me one more. Do success rates take into account variables such as fibroids, endo, adenomyosis? So the pregnancy rates that I presented from New Life IVF were all patients in that age group. So it doesn't distinguish between whether you've got endometriosis or adenomyosis or fibroids. Everyone is lumped in together. So those pregnancy rates are really representative of the types of people who have IVF and the types of people who need IVF. So I think you can expect that that they are representative for what you could achieve if you were having IVF. So that is the conclusion of all the questions. Thank you all very, very much for virtually attending and being so engaged. We do enjoy putting on these nights. We hope you found it informative. We did enjoy your questions. And like I mentioned, there's a lot more information on our YouTube channel. Please follow us on Instagram, follow us on Facebook. We'll be posting bits and pieces that you'll find informative from time to time. We've got more webinars coming up in future. They're on the first Tuesday of each month. Generally, there's a few months where we skip. However, next month on the 1st of March, again on a Tuesday night at 6:30 p.m. we'll be talking about polycystic ovaries, polycystic ovary syndrome, what the difference is, what it means if you've got it, how is it treated, everything to do with PCO and PCOS, and that'll be a very informative night also. But thank you once again, and just a reminder that this will be released on YouTube very, very soon, and we will release it as a podcast episode also. So if you've got any friends who've missed it, let them know that they will be available. Until next time, thank you and good night.